I think you would agree that impending death, even death itself, has a way of provoking clarity. It is not a sure thing, but there are lessons to be had in the midst of death. I don't have to remind anyone about the kind of tremendous outpouring of grief that we have witnessed over the last week for Jack Layton. No matter what your politics or ideology are or is, you would have to agree that it has brought together people of various stripes across a broad spectrum, those who are seeking to make sense of one whose ideals, more or less for many people, connected with theirs. And yet there is witness after witness of an ordinary man, a politician, yes, but someone who seemed to be able to relate to everyone. There is something very clear indeed that arises from such a context of death. It is clear that we as a community of Canadians are hungry for excuses to be together. It is clear that too often we are consumed by our own preoccupations and convictions to the extent of preventing us from relating to each other, that when something intrudes into the normal state of affairs, something as huge, something as significant, something that touches as close to home as death, we are reminded about what really matters, about who we are, what we are for, and whom we are to serve. It is unfortunate that it takes sometimes such an occasion, but that seems to be human nature. There is a provocation of clarity, hopefully not only for a moment this time. Somehow, what has been intriguing about the reality of Jack's life and values, no matter whether you agree or not, it is also part of the response of people. His civility, his ordinariness, it has somehow catalyzed a broad spectrum of response, of reflection, and of resolve. People asking themselves, I've heard more than one, even commentators, wondering and musing about how will I be remembered when I die? What is it that people will say about me, about my impact on the world, my impact on ordinary people, my impact even on those with whom I disagreed fiercely? What will be said gives us occasion to pause and to reflect. The gospel lesson from Matthew, Jesus speaks about his own suffering and impending death. And even in that context, there is a provocation of clarity. Because Jesus is clear about his calling. This is part of the way of living out obedience to God. But there is, in the midst of such clarity, an attempt to derail it. For Peter rises up and says, "Never, Lord, it shall never be like that. You can't be talking about death and defeat. We're part of the winning team. You called us to follow you. We want to follow you, and we want to win. So don't talk about those things that are detracting and will derail us from such a victory." And Jesus responds, still in the context and fullness of his clarity, "Get behind me, O tempter," or the Satan, accuser. "Get behind me. You," says Jesus, "are a distraction to me. You are a hindrance." So it seems to me that somehow within the context of reflection about one's calling in the midst of impending death and death itself seems to provoke an opportunity for us to clarify for a moment what really is at the base and at the crux of our life. What are we for? What is our calling? What is our purpose for being here? What we hear and see from Jesus is an invitation, once having discerned and accepted that calling, not to be distracted by those seeming supporters who will derail you. Jesus will not be deterred indeed. So life in the I Am, life in God, is about calling, is about vocation, is about discovering purpose. How do we know, we would say? How do we know what we're supposed to be doing? How do I know what my calling is, what my purpose for being on earth is? How do I find that out? I've been trying all my life, some people would say. I still don't know what my purpose is. It's very interesting. Ethicist Andy Fleming from the Emory University Center of Ethics offers a very clear-cut way in which some people, one approach, may engage that. He says, ask yourself three questions. One, what do I like to do? Two, what am I good at? And three, what are the needs to be done in the world, to be attended to? He says, ask those questions, and when you find a convergence of a response for those questions, you will have found what he calls your sweet spot. I suppose that is not a bad way to begin, not a bad way to advance the questioning and the conversation. The truth of the matter, though, is that God seems to have other ideas for those of us who think we have found our sweet spot. Such ideas seem to be a part and parcel of the story of Moses. You remember that story. If you haven't read the biblical version, no doubt you've come across the Cecil B. DeMille version from Hollywood with Charlton Heston and that frizzy hair and all of the theatrics. No doubt you've seen that. Or if you haven't, maybe you're from a younger generation and you've seen the animated Prince of Egypt. So you know something about Moses. But just to trace his lineage and what has brought him to the point of our story today, just very briefly. Abraham and Sarah, these are heirs of Abraham and Sarah. One of them was named Joseph. Joseph found his way, sold into slavery in Egypt to a various amount of circumstances that we learn afterwards that God was somehow behind, that Joseph rises to be the right-hand person for the Pharaoh. And he establishes a great reputation of rulership and discernment and so forth. But we're told very early on in the book of Exodus that a new king arose who did not know Joseph. And there's impending danger even in those words. He didn't know. The Israelites had multiplied, and the concern of this new king was that there were too many, so devised a plan to reduce the population, lest they rise up and overthrow or pose a problem, a security problem for Egypt. He decided and decreed that all male children, all male Hebrew children that were born, were to be killed under threat of death. And we know the story of Shiphrah and Puah, the midwives who disobeyed, civic and civil disobedience in the face of such threat. And they saved Moses, putting him in a basket. Actually, in the Hebrew, an ark. He is arked on the river and guided. Miriam watches and sees and makes sure that makes his way and is discovered by the daughter of the Pharaoh. And you know how the story goes. Adopts him. And through the scheming of Miriam and Moses' mother, they arrange for her to be the wet nurse to raise him and to influence him from very early on. And then when he is weaned, she is dismissed and he's raised in the courts of Egypt. He becomes a prince of Egypt. But there is great dissonance within Moses. You can imagine, the story doesn't go there, but we know if we're dealing with a human person, that there is within him questions and conflicting realities about who he is. His identity is imperiled. Should he align himself with the early lessons he learned at the feet and the bosom of his mother about his Jewish identity? Or should he take all the good schooling and the training that he's received as an Egyptian? Whom should he be? Out of what mode of operation should he find his life coming? Who is he? Egyptian or Jew? Israelite, Egyptian? How do I live? We see some of that confusion perhaps being lived out that gets evoked and expressed in anger. When on one day as a stately prince he is looking down and his heart is wrenched and broken by the savagery that he witnesses that the Egyptian overlords are meting out against the Israelites. And he goes down and he tries to stop one and ends up killing him in a rage, a fit of rage. And he tries to cover it up, buries him in the sand and runs away, but others have seen. And another day he makes his way down to see the Israelites, to try perhaps to connect with them, maybe trying to discover what part of his personality, his identity could link with these Israelites. Somehow he's disturbed by their plight. But they reject him. They are afraid. They say, have you come to kill us too? So in fear of what he has done and fear of being discovered, he runs away. He leaves behind his life as an Egyptian, leaves behind his life of identity with the Israelites and goes into the desert, ends up in Midian, introduced to Jethro. Jethro offers his daughter Zipporah, marries her. They have a son, Gershom, which means in Hebrew, a stranger in this place. It's significant that he named him that because it sums up his identity to some extent. He doesn't know who he is, where he is, to whom he belongs. Is he Egyptian, Israelite? What am I? It is sometimes the confusion of our identity that prevents us from hearing well the calling upon our life that is given by God. We are not sure what we are for, who we are, where we are to rest and plant our feet, as it were, to set up tent. Am I part of the world? Am I part of the maybe the skepticism or the intellectual questions that came upon me when I studied in school, in high school or college, and have caused me to doubt everything? Is that where I'm supposed to find my life? I was brought up in church or Sunday school, and those stories somehow don't seem very real anymore. They don't fit my life, and so I'm not sure. I'm going to reject that. It seems like sports may be the way to go, or fitness. That's what I'll do. Maybe I'll find my life and purpose in that. People are wondering, where do I draw my identity? What is it that I am to ground myself in the way of purpose? The good news is this, that God meets us where we are, wherever we are lost. Here is Moses in the backcountry on the edge of the forest, the wilderness, we're told. He's settled down. He's gotten married. He's working. He's shepherding, taking his sheep out for pasture. That's all he wants to be concerned about now. He's found his purpose, maybe. Maybe for some time in his life, he's found some peace, some ordinariness to life, some routine he can get used to. But God had other ideas. Moses might have said, what am I good at? What's my passion? Where are the world's needs? I've found it. I'm okay. And God, in the story of that burning bush, calls him, catches his attention. But notice it is not direct, and that's a lesson to us. Moses has to step out of his routine somehow. He has to follow his curiosity. You and I have to trust that there is an appetite, an urging in our hearts and our lives for something more, something deeper. Our soul is crying out for its resolution and its life in that which will most satisfy. So even though things look like they are at peace below the surface, there is a wrestling. And that wrestling is what provokes a curiosity that enables us to see how God has put things, people, circumstances in our lives to catch our attention, to invite us to investigate. Moses goes over. Out of that comes the voice. Moses, Moses, here I am. And there's a conversation that follows, a very interesting conversation that betrays where Moses is and where I would like to suggest you and I are way too often. Moses discovers that God has had his heart kindled with deep pathos and pain at the suffering of the people in Egypt. And he is on a mission to rescue them. He says, I have come down and I'm going to deliver them. Moses is thinking, oh, this is good. Yes, God, that sounds great. I was once upset about that too. And look where it got me. I got in trouble. So I'm glad you're here. Go to it. Knock yourself out, God. But God had other ideas. God says to Moses, and I would like you to go. Oh, wait a minute. No, that's not part of the bargain. I was agreeing with you. You tricked me.
I would like you to go. And notice what maneuver Moses employs right after that. What does he do? He starts to go through the excuses. Who am I that I can go? Question of identity. Good one for you and I to ask. Who are we? When God sends us and implants into our life and heart the call and the urgent mission that the world awaits our response to, we find excuses. It can't. You've mistaken. We take the letter of invitation that has come from God and we write return to sender. No, thank you. Who am I that I should go? You're the one I want. You're the one I'm calling, God says. Not only Moses, you. We are the ones that God wants. What will it take to get our attention? Will we find excuses to derail the process like Peter did? Will it take the death of a political leader to maybe get through to our hard hearts and our frightened souls? To think and dream again? That was a moving funeral service yesterday. I don't know if any of you saw it or heard it. In many ways. Dream no small dreams. And we find ourselves encouraged and motivated by leaders still today and those whose memories we lift up that can help us move off of that terrace of fear. Today was supposed to be the public dedication of that monument to Martin Luther King in Washington, D.C., but you know about the storm that has caused that to be postponed. His monument. We were there on holiday about 3 weeks too early. Well, now that the storm has come, maybe it was a good thing. But before that unveiling, but we saw the canvas over that huge monument between the Jefferson and the Lincoln Memorial. And it is to Martin Luther King on the anniversary of his famous I Have a Dream speech, which is today. Martin was one who did not dream any small dreams. For that dream continues to penetrate and evoke response in many ways. Just today, I read that the leader, that Anna, the Indian protester activist who has been calling on the government to respond to the bill for anti-corruption processes, and they have agreed and he has stopped his hunger strike. There are people who respond to the promptings of the one who is the source of justice, the source of true life, the source of true dreaming, and inspire us to do the same. So be careful about the excuses. It's understandable, but God won't stop. And then he says, well, who should I say has sent me? I don't know your name. He thinks he's smarter than God. God responds with a variation of the Hebrew verb to be. I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, or I am who I will be. It's a very mysterious, very ambiguous phrase. Eye esher eye in Hebrew. And it's meant purposely to be slippery so we do not feel we have cornered God and we know all about God. God is not about to reveal God's full identity and name. And so Moses has that to go. And then he finds another excuse. Well, how will they know I go? And they'll say, how do you know? Tell them I am has sent you. You'll be able to perform things to capture their attention, to show that the power is behind you. Well, what if they don't believe that? I don't speak very well. My mouth, I'm not eloquent. I have a speech problem. And God says, I am the source and the creator of the mouth. I will be with you. But just because he complained so much, I'll send your brother Aaron with you. I believe that the point of this, that life in the I am, is a conversation. It is a dance. And you and I, when we're honest with ourselves, we dance according to our insecurities and our fear. But that's okay. Bring those to God because God's big enough to handle them. Bring your resistance and your reluctance. Bring whatever apathy or indifference. Bring your skepticism and your cynicism. Bring it. God says, bring it. Because I can deal with that if you're honest enough to admit that that's where you are. If that's what's holding you back, let's deal with that and we will find a response. We will find a way to get through, to kindle the passion in your soul, to allow you a life in the Spirit of God that glorifies God and blesses and transforms the world. Oh, do we need that? Oh, do we need that? Amen.